member of the Central Committee. It was a bloc of rights and Trotskyites and also included social revolutionaries and church leaders. All the many industrial trusts in the area suffered as well, the heads of Uralmash, Uramdrud, Levi Kostroy, Sivkabel, and others, and their leading engineers, were of course arrested. Other institutions purged. Included the Bacteriological Institute, which lost almost all its staff, including its director, Professor Kutish Childyov, who committed suicide in jail. The institute was closed down, its building being taken over by the NKVD, which certainly needed the space. One cell alone in the local prison now held 27 wives of arrested officials. Malenkov went to Kazan in August 1937 to a plenum of the Tatarsky Provincial Committee, at or after which the first secretary, Lepa, and most other high officials were arrested. At the same time, railway officials of the area were arrested on Kaganovich's orders. Zhdanov oversaw similar operations in various provinces and republics. In Karelia, he violently attacked the leadership, L. Ergels, Guling, Rovio, and others, all of whom were arrested as Finnish spies. All the 10 Finnish-language newspapers were closed down. At a meeting of the Bashkir Provincial Committee on 4-October 6, 1937, Zhdanov announced that the leading posts were held by bourgeois nationalists, Trotskyites, fascist diversionists, spies and murderers. B. Bykin, the local first secretary, was an old spy. He and almost all the local party and government leadership were arrested, including all the members of the party bureau and heads of departments. The local prison was not large enough for such an operation, and the victims were shot in ravines and quarries, Bykin's pregnant wife among them. In Novosibirsk, the daughter of the head of the West Siberian Medical Department, Maxim Thalman, tells us, in a recent Soviet article, how on 16 August 1937 her father was arrested with most of the local leadership. Her mother, sister of the former Central Committee member Vladimir Milutin, followed on 3 September, and then all the leaders' wives and children over 16. Only a few of the arrested survived. The daughter, aged 17, was one of 250 then held in a local NKVD children's home, and this was only one of several such homes. There were some special cases. Josef Horakis, who had been very much in Stalin's confidence, and had served as first secretary in Voronezh and Stalingrad, was now first secretary of the Far Eastern Territory. He telephoned Stalin in September 1937 with a query about the reasons for the arrest of certain communists. In the conversation he put some question about the arrest of Tukhachevsky. He had served with him in the Civil War. When the two had at one time been seized by social revolutionary mutineers, whom they had eventually suppressed. Stalin shouted, "That is not your business. Don't interfere in what doesn't concern you. The NKVD knows what it's doing." He then went on to say, "Only an enemy would defend Tukhachevsky," and threw down the telephone. Varikis was deeply shaken. He told his wife that he could hardly believe it was Stalin. On 30th of September, he got a telegram summoning him to the capital on official business. On 9th of October, he was arrested a few stations out of Moscow. His wife was arrested 4 days later. He was mentioned as a plotter in the Boldier in Tria 1, and was later shot. It seems very probable from the context that the conversation must have had something to do with the position of Marshal Blücher, who commanded in the Far East, and that Stalin's lapse into open rage may have reflected a real anxiety about trouble from the Far Eastern Army. In the Republics. In the Republics, things went in the same way as in the provinces of Russia proper. In the Belarusian Republic, the verification of party cards ordered in 1935 and 1936 was used by Yazhov to expel, in connection with an alleged anti-Soviet underground, more than half of the entire membership. The local officials opposed these actions, which amounted to the first phase in the destruction of the old party and the rebuilding of another on its ruins. After the February-March plenum, on March 17, 1937, V. F. Sharangovich, as an emissary of the center, was sent to take over the Belarusian first secretaryship. The resistance was widespread at the highest level in the Republic. M. Gloded, chairman of its Council of People's Commissars, cast doubt upon the results of the verification at a meeting of the local Central Committee. This was made the occasion for the dispatch of Malenkov, in June 1937, to destroy the leadership. A plenum of the Belarusian Central Committee was summoned. Violent accusations of espionage were made. Chervyakov, chairman of the Belarusian Supreme Soviet, that is, head of state of the sovereign republic, committed suicide. Gloated. 9937. Was charged with bourgeois nationalism, arrested on the way to Moscow, and shot. Almost the entire leadership of the republic, including the Central Committee secretaries, the People's Commissars, and many leaders of local party and Soviet bodies and representatives of the creative intelligentsia were expelled from the party and many of them were arrested. Throughout the summer and autumn, the purge spread down to the local and mass level. At a local party congress held in mid-June, Sharangovich warmly celebrated the purge then in progress. His own fall came at a Belarusian Central Committee plenum in August, when Yaya Yakovlev, sent there from Moscow, denounced him in turn. The resolutions referred to the Polish spies, Glodid, Sharangovich, Banek, Chervyakov and other wreckers and diversionists. Sharangovich's fate is typical of a significant phenomenon. The new generation of Stalinist careerists, who had adapted themselves completely to the new system, still found themselves arrested. This is particularly the case among the first and most energetic batch who had worked up to high positions. They were succeeded by younger but similar characters, who again often fell quickly. The shortness of their tenure has been explained as follows. People of their type tended, in their unscrupulousness and zeal, to carry the party line to absurd extremes, with the result that their actions had later to be explained away as deviations. People of this type were also inclined by nature to corruption and the exploitation of their positions for personal advantage. They thus roused the hatred and envy of their juniors. This further contributed to the shortness of their stay in office. Stalin's idea, announced at the February, March plenum, of having two stand-ins for every post, showed foresight, but did not go far enough. In many cases, it was only the fourth or fifth nominee who was to keep the post through the ensuing years. Apart from politicians and engineers, the Belarusian purge struck most heavily at the cultural leadership, and at the Linguistic Institute and the Commissariat of Education, in particular, where the principle of the separate Belarusian nationality had been concentrated. Belarusians, almost invariably, were ex officio Polish spies, owing to the geographical position of the republic. On 29 and October 30, 1937 there was a mass execution of Belarusian cultural and political figures, M. Zinishkevich, Belarusian second secretary, and at least 11 others, including the poets U. A. Taubin and M. S. Kolbayak, together with such other writers as I. D. Karik, A. Bolny, and V. P. Kovel. The Belarusian case is interesting in that it seems to show a rather more stubborn opposition than that offered in the provincial committees, perhaps owing to some reliance on local feeling. This was to be far more noticeable in the Ukraine, where a large concentration of high officials made final subjugation a more difficult matter. In Georgia, where in 1919 the Mensheviks had won 105 out of the 130 seats in the National Assembly, trademark there was by now no need of a purge at the top. The thin face, Pensnezd Beria, the old Ogbu operative Stalin had infiltrated into the Transcaucasian First Secretaryship in 1931, was in full control, and had already been purging enthusiastically. As early as August 11, 1936 he had even shot, in his own office, the Armenian First Secretary, Khan Zayan. So Georgia's intra-party purge was violent but routine. No emissary of the Central Committee was required to enforce it. But the Republic was the scene of several publicly announced trials, though these were not actually held in public. The most important came on 10 to July 12, 1937. Men as prominent, on the narrower stage of Georgian Bolshevism, as the leading victims of the Moscow trials were brought to trial. It was evidently intended, originally, to make this, too, a show trial. For all the men involved were old enemies of Stalin's. Chief among them was Budum Divani, former premier of Soviet Georgia, whose defense against Stalin Lenin had undertaken just before his death, whose case, indeed, had been Lenin's final reason for wishing to remove Stalin from the general secretaryship. With him were the old Bolshevik Okudzava and others. Their trial is said to have been decided on at the February, March plenum. But they had long since been incriminated. Divani had been denounced as long ago as 1929 for illegal Trotskyite activity, but had become reconciled to the party because, as he said, he felt too old to start another. At the Zinoviev trial, though Divani's name was not mentioned, the Georgian deviationists were, as we saw, specially noted as having had an attitude which is as well known was terroristic from 1928 onwards. At the time of the Zinoviev trial, this was a record. No other group had then been charged with terrorist plans before the 1930s. At the Pyatakov trial, Divani was accused of having planned a terrorist act against Yuzhov and another against Beria. And after his death, at the Bukharin trial of 1938, he was described as a British agent. He was arrested in early October 1936. To the first attempts to get him to confess, he is said to have answered, "You are telling me that Stalin has promised to spare the lives of old Bolsheviks. I have known Stalin for 30 years. Stalin won't rest until he had butchered all of us, beginning with the unweaned baby and ending with the blind great-grandmother. He was then cruelly beaten and held in hot and cold cells, from the former, where he spent several days, he was taken out in half-dead condition, with his pulse barely detectable. He was also threatened with the death of his children, and was told that his wife had already been buried in the prison grounds. The wife, their four sons, and their daughter all perished. The one daughter-in-law survived imprisonment. On January 15, 1937, he finally confessed. At the trial, however, where they were accused of terrorism, espionage, and links with emigre Georgian Mensheviks, he and Okudzava are reported as having fiercely denied their guilt. The Georgian Supreme Court sentenced them to death, and they were shot. Two parallel trials in the two autonomous republics within Georgia, Adzeria and Abkhazia, remove the equivalent veterans there on 29 September and 29 October, respectively. In the former, the old Bolshevik Nestor Lakoba, who had died on December 28, 1936 as a result, it is now said, of some intrigue of Beria's, was posthumously accused of a plot on Stalin's life. Lakoba's wife was tortured for evidence against her husband. The interrogators threatened to shoot her 14-year-old son if she did not testify, but she refused. She died as a result of the torture, and the son was shot. Meanwhile, a fresh assault on the new generation of second-line leaders was mounted. The dates of arrest of a number of Georgian and Transcaucasian communists rehabilitated in 1964 and 1965 are given as 1 to September 3, 1937. A general terror operation without the publicity of the oppositionist trials was starting. Over 1937 and 1938, 4,238 promotions to senior Georgian party, state, and economic posts were made, that is, to leadership posts. The total party membership had been 34,000 at the 17th Congress, and the implication is that virtually the whole leading cadre was destroyed. The Armenian Party had been under general attack since May. Suspicious people were found to be in the party apparatus. During the summer, Ter Gabrielian, who had been chairman of the Council of People's Commissars in 1935, was interrogated for 7 hours in the office of the head of the local NKVD about alleged embezzlement on the railways, and killed on the spot. Stalin then sent a letter to the Armenian Central Committee alleging that Ter Gabrielian had been a plotter liquidated by his accomplices to cover their traces. On September 15, 1937, a plenum of the Armenian Central Committee was held in Yerevan, and the decisive blow was struck. The All-Union Central Committee was represented by Mikoyan, supported by Beria and Malenkov. Under the new constitution, Armenia no longer formed part of the old Transcaucasian Socialist Federal Soviet Republic ruled by Beria. It still came under his aegis in a general way, but in this case it was not thought to be an intrusion when Malenkov was sent on Stalin's direct instructions to carry out the operation. Malenkov stopped off at Tbilisi on his way to Yerevan to concoct a story about the death of Khanzayan, whom Beria had shot, to their mutual satisfaction. The rest of the Armenian leadership was now to be blamed for the crime. The first secretary, Amidany, is said to have put up a stout resistance and to have shouted back, "You lie." He was, however, arrested, together with the second secretary, the chairman of the Council of People's Commissars, the president of the Republic, and the head of the NKVD, and was denounced as an enemy of the people on 23 September. Almost the entire leadership of Armenia's Central Committee and Council of People's Commissars was illegally arrested. Malenkov personally interrogated the prisoners, using proscribed methods in the process. In this third week of September 1937, there was a wave of mass arrests throughout the Republic. Of the Bureau of 16 members and candidate members elected in June 1935, none were left at the end of September 1937. Of those who formed the new Bureau in 1937, only two remained in 1940. Of the Central Committee of 55 elected in June 1937, only 15 were re-elected just a year later in June 1938, and they included the non-local names of Stalin, Beria, and Mikoyan. About 30 of those removed can be traced as having been expelled from the party and probably arrested. As in Georgia, the whole second level of the party went too. Over 3,500 responsible party, Soviet, economic, military, and Komsomol officials were arrested, in a few months of 1937 alone. Many of them were shot without a trial in the requisite investigation. On the last day of the year, the execution of 8 leading Armenian officials was announced, together with, ironically enough, the posthumous disgrace of Khanzayan. The launching of mass arrests in both Georgia and Armenia in September was not a coincidence. A general decision to destroy the old parties in the National Republic seems to have been taken. By midsummer, the entire Government of the Tatar Republic was under arrest. September saw the sudden start of a press campaign conducted in more violent terms than ever, on a threat about which not much had been heard for some time, bourgeois nationalism. Such articles as the rotten position of the Dagestan Provincial Committee became common. From about 8 September, the parties in the minority areas were subjected, under heavy headlines, to a continual stream of abuse. In Uzbekistan, Kyrgyzstan, Kazakhstan, Bashkiria, Karelia, everywhere, large groups of traitors were found in the leaderships, in fact, constituting the leaderships. The most prominent of these, the Uzbek, we will deal with in connection with the Bukharin trial, see here. The pattern that emerges in the purge in the republics and provinces is a striking one. It amounts to this: an operation planned in Moscow and carried into effect by missions from the center almost everywhere destroyed the old party, raising up instead from the rank and file a special selection of enthusiasts for a new organization of terrorists and denouncers. What requires the most emphasis is the sheer extent of the changes, the completeness of the liquidation of the hierarchy. At the center, Stalin had already created his own cadres, and infiltrated them into high position. In the coming months, the ravages were to be very great in Moscow too, but there was a continuity provided by a handful of men at the top and a group of Stalin's junior nominees in the instruments of power. In the provinces, the Black Tornado really uprooted the old party-line Stalinists, the veterans who represented a continuity, however tenuous, with the old party of the underground, of 1917, and of the Civil War. This amounted to a revolution as complete as, though more disguised than, any previous changes in Russia. We may incidentally note a lesser point: whereas previously the party secretary had been the most powerful man in any area, it was now the NKVD chief who counted. Over the next year or two, the new party executives were to regain a good deal of their power. But for the moment, the police, themselves purged and purged again, were the direct agents of the center and executors of its main missions. Devastated area, the Ukraine. And Kiev groaned with sorrow. The armament of Igor. Stalin's victory over the party was assured when he crushed moderate hopes at the February, March plenum. All that was left to do was to set the machinery of the purges in motion. There was to be one last flicker of resistance, in the Ukraine. In the Central Committee, the great cities, the provincial capitals, the smaller republics, those who had opposed the purge were isolated figures impotently awaiting their fate. In the Ukraine alone, most of the old leadership, based on its local Central Committee, remained in control. The demotion and removal of Postyshev had removed one hostile leader. But Petrovsky at least was one of the doubters. Postyshev's place was taken by his predecessor in the post, Kataevich, a full member of the All-Union Central Committee, who had been on the Ukrainian Politburo since 1933. A considerable purge in the lower ranks took place under an order from the All-Union Central Committee in the weeks following the February, March plenum. Nearly one-fifth of Ukrainian party members were expelled, and two-thirds of the provincial and one-third of the local leaderships were changed. But in the main, the old leadership was re-elected at the Ukrainian Party Congress in May to June. This Congress passed resolutions condemning errors in all ideological fields: the press, the Marx-Lenin Institute, the Institute of Red Professors, and elsewhere, and made strong attacks on Postyshev and the old Kiev leadership. Kosyur, who had been comparatively mild at the time of Postyshev's demotion, now spoke of lack of vigilance at the top which had allowed Trotskyites to penetrate the Kiev Provincial Committee. A day or two later, he denounced Postyshev by name for co-opting numerous enemies into the provincial apparatus. It was presumably the unfortunate Karpov who was meanwhile referred to by a Moscow party periodical in a denunciation of a former secretary of the Central Committee of the Ukraine, who had refused to believe accusations that one of his staff was a Trotskyite and had left him in a post in which, until his arrest, he had access to secret documents. The Ukrainian party had a special history. Lenin had underestimated Ukrainian national feeling. The 1917 vote in the Ukraine for the Constituent Assembly was 77% to the Social Revolutionary Party's, 10% to the Bolsheviks. The local Soviets were usually under anti-Bolshevik control. From 1917 to 1920, Ukrainian nationalist regimes of various types were in existence, and Bolshevik rule was imposed and reimposed very largely from outside. Unlike the situation in Russia proper, an important section of the Ukrainian Communist Party itself had originally come from the left Social Revolutionaries. Their main body in the Ukraine had turned nationalist, under the name Borodist. This party was dissolved early in 1920, and several thousand of its members, including Leshenko and Grinko, entered the Communist Party. Time and time again, Bolshevik leaders sent to the Ukraine with strong centralizing views modified them over the years. The attempt to rule solely as agents of a foreign power, through a handful of Quislings, was seen as in the long run non-viable. It was a problem of the type which repeated itself in Hungary and elsewhere after the Second World War. Csubar, who was to be moderate on this issue, became premier of the Ukraine in July 1923. But in 1925, Kaganovich was sent to Kiev as first secretary. His centralizing policy was unpopular in the local party, which otherwise had no quarrel with Stalin. Stalin himself writes of a demand from the Ukraine in 1926 that Kaganovich be replaced by Grinko and Csubar. Registered Stalin, involved in his great struggle at the center, did not wish for a quarrel with the more moderate faction in the Ukraine simply on this local issue. When, in July 1928, Kaganovich was removed from the Republic, Stalin, as Bukharin put it, bought the Ukrainians by withdrawing Kaganovich from the Ukraine. He was replaced by Stanislav Kosyr, a short, bald, bullet-headed Pole who backed Stalin unreservedly right up to the Azov period. In the years of dispute with the left and right oppositions, Stalin's calculations proved correct. The Ukrainian party gave no trouble. There seems to have been very little Trotskyism in it. And in fact, the national minorities in general disliked Trotsky more than Stalin. Even after experience of Stalin's rule, an Ossetian communist believed that while Trotsky's intended method of rule was in general identical with Stalin's, on the nationality question Trotsky was even more reactionary. And the Ukrainian experience with the oppositionists had not been reassuring. Pyatakov, who had briefly ruled in Kiev during the Civil War, had put the view that the Ukraine must submit to Russia very bluntly, can. We'd declare that the form of existence of proletarian peasant Ukraine can be determined solely and absolutely by the working masses of the Ukraine? Of course not. In the early 1930s, the collectivization campaign had turned the Ukraine, more than anywhere else, into a battlefield between the party and the population, and party solidarity was the decisive criterion. Non-communist nationalism remained powerful. The trial of 45 leading cultural figures as a union for the liberation of the Ukraine in March and April 1930, and the similar trials which followed it, were directed against a real resistance. This extreme and rigorous purge erased the old Ukrainian intellectuals and left the old Bolshevik Skripnik, in the Commissariat of Education, as the protector of only a residue of Ukrainian culture. This, however, he determined to defend. There is no doubt that Skripnik and his genuine feeling of resistance to Moscow represented a powerful trend among the rank and file of the party. But the rest of the leadership were in a different position. Stalin's war on the peasantry had truly placed them in a position in which, in Lenin's phrase, who whom? Was the only immediate question. Whatever their hidden reservations and whatever they may have thought of the plans which had led to the crisis, they could no more be expected to indulge them than a general fighting a desperate battle can spend time arguing about the strategic errors of the high command. But still, they seemed to have become shaken and exhausted by the loyal fulfillment of Stalin's collectivization orders. On January 24, 1933, a resolution of the All-Union Central Committee attacked the Ukrainian party. The party organs in the Ukraine have not succeeded in carrying out the party charges entrusted to them in the areas of organization of grain storage and completion of the plan for grain collection. This heralded the climax of the fearful terror famine which reached its peak in March and April 1933, leaving millions dead in the Ukraine. Three of the seven provincial secretaries were censured and removed, together with three members of the local Politburo and Secretariat. And Postishev, hitherto secretary of the All-Union Central Committee, was sent to the Republic as second secretary, with plenary powers. Throughout 1933, non-Ukrainian party workers of more unquestionable loyalty were transferred into the Republic from Russia. It is estimated that there were some 5,000 of these. From 8 to June 11, 1933, Skripnik was strongly attacked. He refused to recant, and was violently rebuked by Postishev for his attitude. Other attacks followed in the press, and on 7 July he committed suicide. His example may have been the Ukrainian writer Kvilovy, who had just done the same when accused of excessive Ukrainian feeling. Skripnik had been one of the three representatives of underground organizations who had gone to the Conference of Bolshevik Leaders in Paris in 1909. The day after Skripnik's suicide, Pravda described it as an act of cowardice. Skripnik, an unworthy member of the Central Committee, had fallen prey to bourgeois, nationalist mistakes. And, as Petrovsky said, TT was not easy for us to ward off these nationalist attacks, since the chief aggressor was an old Bolshevik, Skripnik. However, Petrovsky added, Moscow had helped by sending well-known party members to aid us. Skripnik's supporters were disposed of by the unmasking of a Ukrainian military organization consisting mainly of the post-1930 generation of academic leaders in the Institute of Linguistics, the State Publishing House, the School of Marxist Philosophy, and the Shevchenko Institute of Literary Scholarship. Many further trials of intellectuals followed. But after Skripnik's death, there were no major attacks on the party cadres of the Ukraine until Postyshev's fall in early 1937. When Chubar was called to Moscow to be All-Union Vice Premier, he was replaced as chairman of the Ukrainian Council of People's Commissars by Panas Leshenko, a former Borodist, who shared his views, a slight and light-bearded figure with a sensitive, intellectual face, who had given satisfaction by his firmness in the collectivization struggle. But there were long-standing feuds and factions in the Ukrainian party. By the time the purges started, Postyshev and the head of the Ukrainian NKVD, Belitsky, were working against Leshenko. They were later joined by M.M. Popov, third secretary of the Ukrainian Central Committee, who around the end of 1936 fabricated a case and went to Stalin and Kosyur to demand Leshenko's dismissal and arrest as a Borodist plotter. But Stalin, as we have seen, was now tuming against Postyshev. And after the February-March plenum, not only Postyshev, but also Belitsky and Popov were transferred from the Ukrainian party, and a purge swept the party officials at the provincial and local level. With the defeat of the Postyshev-Belitsky-Popov group, it looked as though Leshenko and the remainder of the leadership were in a strong position. But, in fact, both factions were destined to destruction. A Politburo commission from Moscow, which included Molotov and Yazhov, is reported in Kiev about this time, seeking further changes but meeting with some resistance. At any rate, a new offensive was soon prepared, and a new NKVD People's Commissar for the Ukraine was named, I.M. Leplevsky, fresh from his triumphs in the Tukhachevsky investigation. He brought with him a large force of new NKVD men. And Kosyur, who had earlier shown some signs of resistance to the purge, was now put under strong pressure, and saved himself temporarily by accepting and implementing Moscow's directives. When Army Commander Yakir was arrested, his interrogators had sought an admission that Belitsky was a member of the military conspiracy. On June 7, 1937, Yakir testified that Belitsky had done good work, but had falsified certain cases, including the one against Leshenko, and that Belitsky and Postyshev had falsely attacked Ukrainian nationalists, again meaning Leshenko and his circle. Leshenko's great detractor M.M. Popov, arrested on June 17, 1937, by 22nd of June was confessing to a military fascist organization aiming to kill Stalin and overthrow the Soviet regime. But now not only Belitsky, but also Leshenko, and Postyshev's replacement as Ukrainian second secretary, M. Kataevich, were implicated. At the same time, Popov testified more vaguely to the Polish connections of Kosyur, Postyshev, and Leshenko. Belitsky, who had just assumed his new post as head of the Far Eastern NKVD, was arrested on 7th of July. By 26th of July, he had implicated many of his NKVD juniors in the Ukraine. Signs began to accumulate of pressure being put on the Ukrainian leaders. When greetings were sent to Chkalov and his aircrew on June 20, 1937, those from Moscow were signed with the names of the leaders, but that from the Central Committee of the Communist Party of the Ukraine was anonymous, contrary to previous practice. On 15th of July, leading organs in the Republic were attacked, in particular for the transfer of Postyshev's Trotskyites from Kiev to other posts throughout the Ukraine. On 21st of July, the Ukrainian radio came under heavy attack. At the same time, the Ukrainian Komsomol was severely criticized, and one of its secretaries, Klinkov, denounced as an enemy of the people, and the Central Committee of the Ukrainian Party was criticized as such for tolerating the subversive work of the enemy among the youth. In glorious, royal Kiev city, commanding the great plain from the cliffs of the Dnieper, everything appeared normal to the uninformed observer. In the tranquil Ukrainian summer, the concerts went on regularly in the cypress-walled outdoor auditorium. But even the musicians were under pressure, with all the other cultural agencies, and the director of the Ukrainian state opera, Yanovsky, was soon to be among those denounced as fascists. A plenum of the new Ukrainian Central Committee met on 29th of August. Kosyur, with the new NKVD commissar, Leplevsky, ran it in the harshest Stalinist spirit. The agenda was 1. On the discovery of the nationalist anti-Soviet organization. 2. Other matters. First, it was proposed that a number of enemies of the people who had already been arrested should be expelled from the committee: Kataevich, Sarkisov, Donetsk provincial secretary, and at least 20 others named. Kosyur then announced that he had received a document from Yazhov with the confession of A.A. Kvilia, head of the Ukrainian Arts Administration, implicating Leshenko. Kvilia, also a former Borodist, had been the subject of an NKVD accusation in the autumn of 1936, accused of being a nationalist and counter-revolutionary. Lyushenko and Kosior had vouched for him and others in a confrontation in Stalin's presence. However, he had been rearrested on August 13, 1937, with other former Borodists, and he eventually confessed. By 23rd of August, evidence of a plot by former Borodists was in Yazhov's hands. And with this document as his text, Kosior denounced the new bourgeois nationalist organization just uncovered, which had had close contacts with the previously unmasked anti-Soviet organization headed by Yakir, Beletsky, and Popov. Lyushenko was the leader of this new conspiracy. At 11 a.m. on 30th of August, Lyushenko rose to defend himself, but was shouted down by Leplansky and others. Zhytomsky, a former physics teacher, now Ukrainian Commissar for Education, and one of the most prominent Ukrainian old Bolsheviks, more vaguely implicated, tried to cover himself by allegations that not only Lyushenko but also his wife were members of the nationalist organization. Many violently attacked Lyushenko, though Petrovsky and a few others remained silent. Kosior then proposed the expulsion and arrest of Lyushenko, and this was carried. The case of Zhytomsky was referred to the Politburo. Lyushenko, still not under arrest, went back to his house and shot himself and his wife. Pravda, omitting reference to his wife, announcing his suicide on 2nd of September, attributed it to his being entangled in anti-Soviet connections. But a recent Soviet analysis of the affair tends to the view that NKVD men came to arrest him, he resisted and was shot, and they then disposed of his wife as an inconvenient witness. Grinko, USSR People's Commissar of Finance, the other major exportist, was arrested in Moscow on the same day. Over the next year, the whole of the local Politburo, Orgbüro, and Secretariat were arrested, with the exception of Petrovsky. Of the 102 members and candidate members of the Ukrainian Central Committee, three survived. All 17 members of the Ukrainian government were arrested. All the provincial secretaries in the Ukraine fell. The purge swept through every sort of establishment in the Republic. The state industrial enterprises, the municipal councils, the educational and scientific bodies, all lost their leaders by the hundred. The Ukrainian Union of Writers was practically annihilated. Violent attacks on Ukrainian institutions started to appear. The Kiev and Kharkov radio stations were accused of having broadcast funeral marches after the announcement of the verdict in the first two trials, while the Kiev station had actually gone off the air while the verdict on the generals was being transmitted. This was the result of an enemy organization which the Ukrainian Central Committee had failed to understand. The educational system was attacked as being riddled with nationalists. The museums were also full of spies concerned only to stress anti-Russian Ukrainianism. The Republic had even failed to celebrate Peter the Great's victory at Poltava. Tilde the oppositionists in the three great trials were traitors, Trotskyites, spies, and accomplices of the fascists. But they were not shown as actually describing themselves as fascists pure and simple. In the Ukraine, though, it was not a bloc of rights and Trotskyites that was revealed, but nothing less than a national fascist organization headed by Lyushenko, leader of the Soviet government of the Republic, and including Grinko, People's Commissar of Finance in Moscow, Beletsky, Zhytomsky, Yakir, and a variety of leading figures in the Ukrainian government and Central Committee, and such cultural lights as Yanovsky. For the moment, however, Kosior was spared. At a meeting of the Kiev Party Organization on 15 and September 16, 1937, he delivered another attack on the band of bourgeois nationalists uncovered in the Ukraine. Zhytomsky was severely blamed and in reply could not say anything. Zhytomsky was refused entry to the October 1937 plenum of the Central Committee in Moscow. On 3 November, he was called out of a university meeting in Kiev and arrested. The turnover was equally rapid at the local level. Kudryavtsev, who had replaced Postishev in his lesser post as secretary of the Kiev Provincial Committee of the party and made some of the most violent attacks on Lyushenko in August, was removed at the end of 1937, to be denounced as an enemy of the people. Tilda and his successor, D. M. Evtushenko, followed on April 17, 1938. They were later linked as the centers of a hostile leadership which had subverted most of the district secretaries of the province. Lyushenko was succeeded as premier by a young communist, M. I. Bondarenko. He, too, was arrested within 2 months, and for a time there was no premier at all. Instead, the names of unknown subordinates of Petrovsky appeared on decrees. Then another premier, N. M. Marchik, was appointed. He was demoted to deputy premier by February 1938, and was soon afterward under arrest. He is said to have been drinking heavily with Leplansky one night, and to have exchanged with him some remarks skeptical of Tukhachevsky's guilt, a point on which Leplesky was particularly well informed. The next morning, Marchuk remembered this and thought that Leplesky might have been acting as a provocateur. He rang Yazhov and denounced Leplesky, who was arrested. Leplesky, in turn, implicated Marchuk, and both confessed to conspiracy, terrorism, and espionage. Leplesky's replacement, the third Ukraine NKVD commissar to be appointed within a year, was Uspensky, himself to fall within months. The purge was so complete and so quick that legal authority virtually disintegrated. There was no longer a genuine quorum of the Ukrainian Central Committee or a body capable of appointing a government. People's commissars, irregularly appointed, emerged for days or weeks and then themselves disappeared. The unprecedented sweep of the political leadership marked the effective destruction of the Ukrainian party. The republic became little more than an NKVD fief, where even the formalities of party and Soviet activity were barely gone through. Finally, in January 1938, a presumably spurious plenum of the Ukrainian Central Committee elected Khrushchev first secretary. Khrushchev brought with him from Moscow a new second secretary, Burmistenko, who had served in the CK for many years in the 1920s and later worked closely with Stalin's personal secretariat. As chairman of the Council of People's Commissars, he brought Demian Karachenko, or Karachenkov, in 1939. In a stenographic report of the 18th Congress, his name is actually given with its Ukrainian spelling in the list of the new Central Committee, and with its Russian spelling in the list of delegates to the Congress. In May and June 1938, the entire Ukrainian government was again replaced. Between February and June, all 12 new provincial secretaries were again removed, together with most of their second secretaries. At the 14th Congress of the Ukrainian Party in June 1938, the new Central Committee had, among its 86 members and candidates, only three survivors from the previous year, all non-political or honorary figures. The continuity of rule had for the first time been completely destroyed. Not one member of the new Politburo, Orgbüro, or Secretariat had previously served. The Politburo was a farcical rump with only six members, Khrushchev, Burmistenko, and Karachenko, the commander of the military district, Timoshenko, the latest NKVD chief of the republic, Uspensky, and the ubiquitous Sherbakov, who was in the republic for a few months to purge a couple of provincial committees. They reconstructed the party from the ground up. In 1938, 1,600 party members were raised to be secretaries of district and city committees in the Ukraine. Among those who benefited was the young Leonid Brezhnev. He had been raised to deputy mayor of Dneprodzervinsk in May 1937. In 1938, under the Khrushchev regime, he was promoted to be head of a department of the Dneprodzervinsk Provincial Committee, and by the following year was a secretary of that committee. He never looked back. Few were so lucky. Between 1938 and the next Republican Party Congress. In 1940, attrition remained high, if not so high. Of the 119 elected in 1940, 73 were new members. Stalin and Khrushchev had succeeded in destroying the old party cadres in the Ukraine, and replacing them with men distinguished only by disciplined acquiescence in, or enthusiasm for, the new method of rule. This did not solve the problem of the Ukrainian people. Stalin was to tell Roosevelt at Yalta that his position in the Ukraine was difficult and insecure. And he later regretted that it was impracticable to deport the entire nation, as he had done with the smaller Chechens and Kalmyks. Trademark. At the center. While the punitive expeditions sent out by Stalin and Yazhov harried the provinces, Moscow remained the storm center. Of the 71 full members of the Central Committee, about two-thirds were normally stationed in the capital. All the full members of the Politburo except Kosyr, the People's Commissars, the heads of Central Committee departments, of the Komsomol, of the trade unions, the Comintern's managers, all the concentration of power of a highly centralized machine. Over this major sector of the purge, Stalin and Yazhov themselves presided. They received valuable help from Molotov and Voroshilov when required, but on the whole Stalin kept an extremely tight personal grip on proceedings, working through Yazhov alone. In 1937 and 1938, Yazhov sent into Stalin 383 lists, containing thousands of names of figures important enough to require his personal approval for their execution. As Yazhov was only in power for just over 2 years, and, in fact, his effective working period was rather less, this means that Stalin got such a list rather more often than every other day of persons whose cases were under the jurisdiction of the military collegium. A Samizdat historian of the 1970s indicated that the lists included 40,000 names. However, a Soviet periodical now tells us that at a recent plenum of a Central Committee, the total number shot, whose names appeared on lists signed by Stalin, Molotov, Kaganovich, and Malenkov, though perhaps over a longer period, was given as 230,000. At any rate, we can envisage Stalin, on arrival at his office, as often as not finding in his entree a list of a few hundred names for death, looking through, and approving them, as part of the ordinary routine of a Kremlin day. We are told in recent Soviet articles that on December 12, 1937 alone, Stalin and Molotov sanctioned 3,167 death sentences, and then went to the cinema. The lists were in the following form. Comrade Stalin. I am sending for your approval four lists of people to be tried by the military collegium. List No. I, General, List Number 2, Former Military Personnel, List Number 3, Former Personnel of the NKVD, List Number 4, Wives of Enemies of the People, trademark I request sanction to convict all in the first degree. Yuzhov? The post-Stalin speaker who quotes this adds that first degree conviction meant death by shooting. The lists were examined by Stalin and Molotov, and on each of them is the notation. Approved, J. Stalin v. Molotov. We learn that in one such set of lists, on August 20, 1938, of 736 names, 200 were of military men and 15 were of wives. The December 12, 1937 list cited above included, with a smaller list of 239 shot on 3rd of December, 49. 110. Members of the Central Committee. As to the executions not requiring approval at quite so high level, on October 18, 1937 alone, Yuzhov and Vyshinsky, acting as a troika, considered 551 names, sentencing every one of them to be shot. It will be seen that in a 16-hour working day, this would give them less than 2 minutes per 111. Case. That their speed was not up to Stalin and Molotov's best effort is probably due to the fact that they had to initial each name, rather than just read them through and sign the list. Decisions to make an arrest, and even warrants, were often signed months before the arrest was carried out. And, in the same way, leading figures were sometimes decorated with high orders on the very day of their arrest. The reason given by an NKVD officer is that the police informed only their immediate superior about the progress of their investigations, and Yuzhov informed only Stalin. When Yuzhov once sent a list of names to Stalin with a note for eventual arrest, to be verified, Stalin wrote on it, "Don't verify. Arrest." Ulrich and Vyshinsky reported regularly to Stalin, and sometimes to Molotov and Yuzhov, about the trials and sentences. Ulrich presented every month a report on the general number of people sentenced for espionage, terrorist and diversionary activity. Stalin read all the reports, on the state of the crop, coal production and, dreadful to say, of the number of people deprived of life. Equals. Molotov is named as suggesting sentencing by lists, rather than by consideration of individual cases. It is certainly true that orders went out to arrest categories rather than individual suspects. A former chairman of the Belarusian Council of People's Commissars tells of being present when the local NKVD chief, Boris Berman, complained to the local first secretary, A. Volkov, Yuzhov has sent again an order to arrest old communists. But where shall I find them? There are none left. Equals. As in the rest of the country, the new offensive had started in May 1937. Fitzroy McLean, watching Stalin on the Red Square reviewing stand on 1st of May, was already struck by the rest of the Politburo, who grinned nervously and moved uneasily from one foot to the other, forgetting the parade and the high office they held and everything else in their mingled joy and terror at being spoken to by him. Stalin's own expression varied between benignity and bored inscrutability. They might well feel alarm, for one of their members was absent. His colleagues had perhaps already discussed his case, in the same way that Zhdanov's Leningrad committee was to discuss Chadov's. Jan Rudzutak, member of the party since 1905, who had spent 10 years in Tsarist prisons and exile, a former full member of the Politburo and now a candidate member, was not among his old comrades. His arrest had apparently just taken place. He was seized at a supper party after the theater. The NKVD arrested everyone present. Four women among them are reported in the Butyrka, still in bedraggled evening dress, 3 months later. His dacha was taken over by Zhdanov. Rudzutak was arrested as allegedly a rightist, leader of a reserve center ready to take over if Bukharin's was exposed, because nobody had ever known of any difference between him and the party. This is, in fact, an admission that Stalinists of long standing were now, for the first time, being arrested, especially, but not only, if they showed any signs of opposing the purge. Rudzutak, in particular, had one very black mark against him, his failure to recommend the death penalty for Ryuten when head of the Control Commission in 1932. Through May, another great heroic diversion, parallel to the exploits of the aviators of the previous year, was spread in the papers day after day. This was the landing, under the direction of Zero Schmidt, of Papanin's group at the North Pole, a fine exploit. The officers of the airlift that took them in and set them up were welcomed by the party leaders, decorated, and publicized round the usual celebrations. At the same time, the camp on the ice drifted through the months, from time to time sending loyal greetings from, and receiving thanks at, the farthest flung outpost of the party and state. Through the spring and early summer, the other great non-political news was a series of plays and ballets attended by the leaders of the party and the announcement of long lists of awards to people's artists in these fields. Meanwhile, as a particularly fine summer lay on the Great Plain, the arrests went on. Former oppositionists continued to fall. Nikolai Krestinsky, former member of the Politburo and secretary of the Central Committee, had been removed from the Foreign Commissariat to be Assistant People's Commissar of Justice of the RSFSR in March. On his transfer, he spoke approvingly of his removal to the party cell, saying that even ex-oppositionists should not, in present circumstances, work in the Foreign Commissariat, where leading figures should have the absolute confidence of the leadership and a spotless past. At the end of May, he was arrested. After a week-long interrogation, he 125 started to confess on about 5th of June. He had been severely tortured, and is described in a recent Soviet article as being in the Butyrka prison hospital for some days with his whole back like a single wound. Bukharin, with whom he was to appear in court as a fellow conspirator 9 months later, Eve had just begun his evidence. The way in which any sort of connection with the arrested oppositionists was made a crime can be seen in the case of the veteran Lomove, party member since 1903, who, representing the Moscow Bureau of the Bolshevik Party, had, after Trotsky, been Lenin's most enthusiastic supporter in the Central Committee and pressing for the seizure of power in November 1917. In June 1937, an official of the USSR State Planning Commission sent a letter to Stalin alleging that G.I. Lomove, Apokov, a member of the Bureau of the USSR Council of People's Commissars Soviet Control Commission, had been on friendly terms with Rykov and Bukharin. Stalin wrote on this letter the instructions to Comrade Molotov. What to do? Molotov wrote, DM for arresting this scum Lomove immediately, V. Molotov. A few days later Lomove was arrested, charged with membership in a right opportunist organization, and shot. Registered. Lomove was to be mentioned at the Bukharin trial as a fellow conspirator with Bukharin against Lenin. But even now, opposition was not entirely crushed. In the last week of June, another plenum of the Central Committee was held, ostensibly to discuss vegetable production. It was the scene of mutual denunciations and disappearances on the spot. Nazaridian, not, indeed, a member of the Central Committee, but of the Lesser Central Revision Commission, whom Orjonikidze had saved in the early 1930s, was arrested while actually on his way to the Kremlin to attend the plenum. In a few months, Stalin had progressed far in his ability to loose the secret police, without attention to political protocol, onto his opponents. His speech is said to have been in ruthless style, demanding, for example, less coddling of prisoners. In the meeting hall, many faces were already missing: Bukharin's and Rykov's, Ruzatak's and Chudov's, Gamernik's and Yakir's, Yagoda's and a dozen others. But the spirit of resistance had not yet been entirely quelled. After the February plenum of the Central Committee, a campaign was raised in the conspirators' circles against Yuzhov. An attempt was made to discredit Yuzhov and the work he was doing in the party, to slander him. Even as late as this June plenum, there was an attempt to block the terror. Pyatnitsky, Kaminsky, and others had met for what came to be called the cup of tea to discuss resistance. Filatov, mayor of Moscow, was among those present and appears to have given them away. He himself was shot later. At the plenum, when it was proposed to grant extraordinary powers to Yuzhov and the NKVD, Pyatnitsky spoke strongly against it, and said that, on the contrary, the NKVD was now out of hand and should be more tightly controlled. During the break, several members of the Central Committee advised him to withdraw his statement, and Molotov suggested that he should think of his wife and family. However, he stuck to his guns. The next day, Yuzhov announced that the NKVD had evidence of Pyatnitsky having been an agent of the Tsarist police. Krupskaya defended his character on the grounds that Lenin had regarded him as one of the best Bolsheviks. Yuzhov proposed a vote of censure against Pyatnitsky. Kaminsky and Krupskaya voted against. Stalin asked why Pyatnitsky did not say what he thought about this. Pyatnitsky then said that if he was not needed he would go, and left. On 7 July, he was arrested. As Molotov had foreseen, Pyatnitsky's wife was arrested and not seen again. His son Igor spent many years in labor camp, and his younger son was placed first with foster parents and then in an NKVD children's home. Kaminsky also spoke against the purges. Among other things, he attacked Beria, denouncing him as a former agent of the Azerbaijan Nationalist Intelligence Service. Kaminsky, who had joined the Bolshevik Party as a medical student some years before the revolution, was arrested that day and was later shot. His wife was only jailed for 2 years, and survived. In the midst of the swing into total terror, yet another diversion was provided by Russian airmen. In June, Chkalov and his crew flew their Ant-25 over the North Pole to Falkland, Oregon, and in July Gromov flew another to San Jacinto, California, setting a world distance record. The two flights, both fine achievements, were the occasion for a further great press campaign, pages and pages of newspapers filled with greetings, meetings, lives of the airmen, photographs, and so on. When Chkalov finally crashed on December 15, 1938, Belyakin, head of the main administration of the aircraft industry, Usachev, director of the plant where the plane had been built, and Timoshevich, the designer, were shot for sabotage. The papers continued to carry general calls to vigilance and accounts of various methods used by the enemy. Pravda drew attention to misprints in the local press which amounted to sabotage, for example, a reference to the Betty, sorrows, rather than the Pobyedy, victories, of socialism. And local trials were frequently reported. But the great blow was that now being delivered against the leading cadres of the regime, which was to ravage the old Central Committee and destroy the next level of the party command in their thousands. For it was now, starting in May 1937, that the flower of Stalin's long-nurtured administrative and political machine began to go. After Rudd's attack, no member or candidate member of the Politburo was to be arrested during the year, and several officials only just junior to them hung on until a specially mounted top-level operation in November and December took them. But for the moment, there was a broad sweep of their subordinates, running as high as men like Antipov, vice chairman of the Council of People's Commissars, party member since 1902, several times arrested under Tsarism, and organizer of underground printing plants, who had been among the half dozen appearing with the Politburo on the May Day platform. In the Central Committee apparatus, Malenkov's department of leading party organs was overseeing a thorough renewal. Another figure who was to be named though not produced as one of the most important links in the Bukharin plot was A. Yakovlev, former People's Commissar for Agriculture, and now head of the Agricultural Department of the Central Committee. He figured prominently in the press over June, and was the rapporteur to the June plenum on its sole published item of discussion, vegetables. In the autumn, he fades out until his extraordinary transmogrification into a rightist in March 1938, an odd appellation for the man who had been a chief operator in the collectivization field. Another head of a Central Committee department now to disappear had at one time almost reached the summits of power, Bauman, head of the Central Committee's scientific department. He had been secretary of the Central Committee and candidate member of the Politburo, as Oglanov's replacement, for a few months in 1929 and 1930. An enthusiastic Stalinist, he had been the scapegoat for the first excesses of collectivization, but he had remained on the Central Committee. Bauman's wife was also arrested, and his 14-year-old son, Volek, sent away to a home. Bauman was shot on October 14, 1937. With him went most of the staff of his department. The head of the parallel, but more important, agitation and propaganda department, Statsky, an old economist who had held the post since 1929, was also arrested about this time. Cynicism prevailed as well as terror. A senior army officer in prison mentioned that he was once cheerfully greeted at a reception by Molotov's wife, with the words Sasha, whatever's this? Why haven't you been arrested yet? She had become head of the Cosmetics Trust, a post she was to hold for some years, through the elimination of her boss, Chkalov, who was sent to the Vorkuta railway camps, and she was to be a member of the 1939 Central Committee, which replaced the men now disappearing. Her own arrest came in 1948. An atmosphere of fear hung over the party and government offices. People's commissars were arrested on their way to their jobs in the morning. Every day, another Central Committee member or vice chairman of a People's Commissariat or one of their more important underlings was disappearing. In one sphere alone, for the moment, joy prevailed. Yazhov was awarded the Order of Lenin on 18 July, an occasion for photographs, leading articles, and general celebrations. Vyshinsky received the same award on 21 July, though with less panache. Orders were now also handed out to many leading police officials. On the completion of the Mdivani case, the Georgian NKVD men received their reward. One notes among them the names of men who a year later were to replace the current operators in Moscow and elsewhere, and who were only to perish at the end of the Beria epoch, in 1953 to 1955, Goglides, Kobolov, Rapava, and their like. Other awards went to a group of Yuzhov's men, including the dreadful Ushakov, Frinovsky, and, as a junior, the long-surviving Elie Vladimirsky, who was to serve Beria and be brought back by him in 1953 to be head of the section for investigating specially important cases, and be shot in December of that year. Yuzhov himself was now to get the highest accolade, a town named for him. On 22nd of July, Kaganovich's protege, the ex-OGPU man Bulganyan, was appointed chairman of the Council of People's Commissars of the Russian Republic. The fall of his predecessor, Sulimov, involved a change in the name of the town of Sulimov, capital of the Cherkas Autonomous Province, which was now suitably renamed Yezhovo-Cherkessk. Bulganyan's later colleague and rival Ithreshchev was conducting his own purge in the local machine of the city and province to the satisfaction of the authorities. He had started in late March, as in Leningrad. Now, at a meeting of the Moscow Provincial Committee on 23 August, he made a series of attacks on local leaders like Filatov, which presaged his disappearance, with many others. Ulyanov, Khrushchev's chairman of the Moscow Soviet until recently, was now filling one of the ministerial vacancies as People's Commissar for Local Industry, and it was from there that he was seized. Like Antipov, Yakovlev, Statsky, and Sulimov, he was a full member of the Central Committee. August saw one of the biggest tourist influxes ever to reach Russia. The visitors noted no public gloom. Once again, a great Soviet flight was being celebrated, that of Levinsky and his N-209 around the Union. The papers were full of celebrations, though they had time also, towards the end of the month, to announce the award of orders of Lenin to the hard-worked military jurists, including Ulrich, Machilovich, and Nikitchenko, the last two described as vice presidents of the military collegium, and to prosecutors like Rodzinski. Meanwhile, the commissars and vice-commissars of the economic commissariats went the way of Ulyanov. Some, like Chernov, commissar for agriculture, removed on 30th of October, Grinko, commissar for finance, and Ivanov, commissar of the timber industry, were to appear in the next great trial. Others, like Emrukhimovich, commissar for the defense industry, who had been appearing with the highest leadership for a few months and lost his post in October 1937, being replaced by Kaganovich's brother, M. Kaganovich, were to be tried in secret. Rukhimovich had supported Stalin against all the oppositionists. Earlier he had been one of Stalin's and Voroshilov's closest accomplices in the intrigues against Trotsky and Tsaritsyn in the Civil War. In the same category comes Lyubimov, People's Commissar for Light Industry, who was removed, with both his assistant commissars, on 7 September. By the end of the year, few commissars apart from Voroshilov and Kaganovich remained. In addition to those already named, the commissars for communications, Kalevsky, for internal trade, Vaitser, for heavy industry, Mislauk, for education, Bubnov, for justice, Krylenko, and for sea and river transport, Yansin, were arrested, together with successive heads of the National Bank and their subordinates. For the moment, we may consider one last case in more detail, that of the naturally sensitive Commissariat of Foreign Trade. Its head, Rosengoltz, was removed on 15 June for other work. Both his assistants, Eliava and Loganovsky, disappeared, Eliava to be shot during the year. Rosengoltz, broad-shouldered, strong-minded, and Jewish, was an excellent administrator. He had in the past few years accommodated himself to the new style of rule. He had been brought up in a revolutionary family. When only 10 years old, my hand, the hand of a child, was used to hide illegal literature during the night and to recover it in the morning from a place where the hand of a grown-up could not reach. He joined the Bolshevik Party at 15 or 16 and was first arrested when 16 years old. At the age of 17, he was nominated as a delegate to the Party Congress. During the revolution, he fought in Moscow, and in the Civil War was prominent at various fronts. He had ruled the Donbas in a ruthless fashion. After a brief flirtation with the Trotsky opposition, he was appointed to the London embassy. In 1928, he returned and had since worked in the government, holding his present post since 1930. Rosengoltz was still referred to as comrade in the June decree releasing him from his post, and for some time no further move was made against him. This was in accordance with a common practice of Stalin's. Arrest was decided on, the dismissal occurred, and then for months the victim was left in some minor post, never knowing when the blow would fall. An American resident in Moscow in August 1937 describes a high official scene, day after day, on a balcony opposite waiting to be arrested. Waiting was killing him. He waited 3 more weeks while the GPU watched and while his wife wasted away. Then the GPU came. Some survivors have described this as psychologically more wearing and destructive even than the eventual imprisonment and interrogation.